Welcome, Brandon. This is Matt.
And I'm Rachel. So this is the final part of Matt's trip to New York, where he's going to talk you through his experiences on Saturday.
Saturday, February 5th.
The weekend, or the day of the actual Whitney visit, I suppose. I don't suppose, I know. So he's going to talk you through that. And there's two previous episodes on this trip as well, if you want to go back and listen to them. One where Matt regales me with his travels, and the second one, which is in the moment.
Yeah, travelogue recorded on the Friday before. Yeah. And yeah, if you haven't listened to the first one, I think it's probably a better overall view. I talk about some of the same stuff, definitely talk about some different stuff.
Yeah, there's some things that we didn't touch on from when I've listened to this. So yeah, I hope you enjoy. And then from here will be a couple of episodes about exploring the Midwest / Mid-Atlantic.
You haven't even said what you're going out to do, did you? Or are we going to leave that as a surprise?
Cryptids. Yeah, I'm paranormal investigations and cryptids, and I'm going to look at some haunted objects and eat some cake.
Sounds like a plan. Welcome to Rain It In. This is Matt, and again, unfortunately, without Rachel this time. This is my day two of a solo trip in New York City, and probably coming at you retrospectively as season 4, episode 3. We'll get back to it in just a second. So today was another big day of art in New York City. It was the whole reason I came to New York City this time was to go to the Jasper Johns retrospective at the Whitney. Has a sibling show happening in Philadelphia, and of course was not able to see that one, but this one was pretty great. Today's day though started out in my hotel up here, sort of next to Koreatown, edge of Chelsea, and had about a mile walk down to the Whitney, stopped for a bagel breakfast and grabbed some coffee, had some pictures of some of that on the Instagram, which is at rainedin_podcast on Instagram or rainedin-podcast on Facebook, and had a little bit of time to kill because I got to the Whitney a little bit early, and I was going to be meeting our friend John there. Ended up going into another gallery called Fort Gavensvoort, I think is maybe how you say that. It's the name of the street that the Whitney's on as well. And super, super interesting show. Winfred Rembert, not an artist that I was familiar with. Probably someone who might be considered self-trained. Well, definitely probably self-trained, but a bit of a outsider. I don't know what the correct term is these days for that, but just super interesting and powerful show. It was really an autobiography of him sort of growing up, but the main gist of the show was, it's a three floor gallery, the Fort Gansvoort. And the top two floors were the majority around this event that happened to the artist who in the mid-60s, I think he said it was 65, that he was doing protests and for civil rights. And during a protest, things sort of went poorly. The police started firing shots. I don't know whether, not quite clear whether that was at people or just in general. The artist and storyteller, I suppose, from his side of the story, that he was fleeing for his life, understandably, and saw a car that had keys in the ignition, which he makes the comment that used to happen back then. And I think about my brother in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, that at least as of a few years ago, it was not uncommon to just put your keys in the ashtray or something like that. But, you know, took a car, broke the law, and was arrested. But the crazy thing was he spent over a year in a county lockup without indication of a trial or charges. Just obviously a, would seem to be from his story, right? A blatant disregard for, you know, normal legal process. And he ended up clogging up the toilet of his cell with some toilet paper to get attention. The deputy came in and, of course, instead of, you know, helping, the deputy, according to the story, started beating the artist, who was the prisoner at the time. And the artist says in his description of the situation that he, you know, feared for his life, wasn't sure what to do, decided he needed to fight back to survive. Turns out that he overpowered the deputy, locked him in the cell, and fled, was later captured by Georgia state troopers, because this is all happening in Georgia, and went back to prison. And while he was in the prison the second time, a mob of white citizens came and broke him out of jail, not broke him out, but to basically take him to be killed. And they had him hung from a tree, was about to kill him, and someone stepped in. The artist doesn't know who it was. All he knows is that he was wearing wingtips. He never saw his face, and convinced the people to not do this. So he ended up going to, you know, being removed from the tree, assumed back to jail, and was eventually tried. Spent some time in a chain gang, and besides just being a horrifically unbelievable story that, you know, is really just a lifetime ago, not all that long ago, that the way he tells this story in his artwork is actually on tooled leather. So it was like large leather sheets that were probably like 24 by 36, maybe a little smaller than that. I think larger than 18 by 24. But, you know, he'd carve in the lines that you would normally do with a drawing, did some tooling, whether it was like hammering the leather or other things, and also dyed it. But I've just supposedly was a art form that he self-taught himself when he was in prison, and just really connects you bodily in a way that I didn't expect to see artwork on leather to be. So that was just kind of started out the day curiously. Once I ended up meeting up with a friend of ours at the Whitney, we went in, started at the top, and oh geez, I don't have it in front of me. I think it's Jennifer Packer. I believe African-American artist as well, who just had these wonderful paintings that were large scale. The way she rendered her a lot, that she did some flowers or some still lifes, I guess. She did a lot of figural and figures in situations with, you know, other stuff in the background. But it was really curious the way she laid out some of the compositions, but also the way she sort of completed some of the paintings. This is going to be hard to explain in words, but there were, you know, pretty large scale paintings, some of them extremely large, like as large as the wall of a, you know, a house, and maybe not quite that large, but big. And the you know, there'd be a figure in it, and a lot of the picture would just be like washes of color with just a little bit of indication that there would be a person or a, you know, a figure there. But then there'd also be really detailed pieces of that too. So maybe the hands would be really detailed, or a part of the face would be really detailed. Or in one case in particular that a friend and I talked about a fair bit was one of them was like a box fan. A lot of the other background was very vague, but there was just this fan that was very detailed. And, you know, to me, almost calling out, you know, seeing this one piece that was more detailed, could almost hear the fan making noise in a way that I don't know if I would have experienced if the rest of the painting had been as finished as the fan and some other pieces of the figure. Also thought there were a couple interesting pieces. I took a couple pictures of it. I think I posted some of them, at least one of them to Instagram. Like one what I thought was really interesting, it reminded me of Michelangelo's, I don't know what the proper name of it was, but it's something like, something about slaves actually too, but they're sort of being freed from the rock. And so there's these bodies and like contortions that are being carved out of the rock, but there's still rock around it. And there's indication that they were just unfinished because he died before they were done. But I also kind of feel like Michelangelo was maybe a little ahead of what we expect, and that he was purposely leaving those pieces around. But you know, that's my take on it. But just this, yeah, like bodies in anguish, so interesting in one. And another one reminded me of William Blake, one of his sort of like, not really illuminated manuscripts, but one of his illustrations for his poems. And there's, I don't know who the hell it is, so it's supposed to be God or an angel or something, but there's a guy reaching down with his hand and there's like a spark off his hand. If you look up William Blake, it's probably like the third image that's going to show up under that search. But there was one where it was a person like playing pool. There was no pool stick, but there was a hand in a very similar position. And then the pool balls, but the pool balls looked like planets. And just the composition seemed very similar. A couple other ones that seemed very influenced by Egon Schiele, but all in ways that felt satisfying, not like she was copying those, right? But she was referencing them. Really impressed by that whole, it was the top floor of the Whitney. If you have a chance to get back there before it ends, I would like definitely encourage you to go for the Jasper Johns, but if you can't make it for the Jasper Johns, like definitely go for, like I said, I think it's Jennifer Packard or Packer. Just a really interesting exhibit. Also checked out the normal collection for the Whitney. Really nice, for sure. There was another temporary exhibit, which was, I don't remember what it is called, but it was around sort of like craft in America. And there were some really interesting pieces in there as well, a variety of different mediums and styles, but sort of those like traditional non-masculine art forms, fabric and ceramics and such. I really enjoyed a lot of that, especially because it was a bunch of pottery. The thing I didn't love, and this is not fair to Betty Woodman, but there were like three pieces by Betty Woodman on that exhibit. And the Whitney doesn't have huge floors for the exhibit space, right? I mean, they're satisfyingly large, but you know, Betty Woodman had three pieces, but a bunch of other notable American ceramicists had none. So, like, I'm not quite sure why that was. But it was nice to see some of the other ones, some pieces that I hadn't seen from artists that I wasn't familiar with. For those that don't know, I actually have a degree in pottery and ceramics. And so it was really nice to see pieces. I always like seeing ceramics in large museums. But other ones that were like not ceramic pieces that were interesting, one that stood out, I do not remember the artist's name, but it was basically this like giant straw hut that also had this figure at the top of it. It was sort of like a motherly figure, and its head was a pot, and the body and arms were made out of clay as well. Just such an interesting presence. So that was great. The Jasper Johns show, though, was everything I was hoping it would be. I really love a retrospective in general, because I like to look at what someone has done throughout their body of work, especially if they've lived an amazingly long and productive artistic career like Jasper Johns. To see something starting in the 50s and then what that same artist is making in like 2019, and seeing significant growth, but also echoes of some of the same ideas throughout that time, again, in a satisfying way, not in like a, like, you know, couldn't they just come up with some new ideas? No, but it's like, you know, his use of sort of like fork and spoon referencing back to a relationship that he had that seems to be symbolic of the relationship he had with Robert Rauschenberg, but also sort of his growing relationships that he had with people like Marcel Duchamp, and references to his silhouette in certain pieces, and other references to like floor plans from his grandmother's house, but all in a way that it sort of made sense to those things. If you don't know who Jasper Johns is, look him up as well. As soon as you look up Jasper Johns, you're going to see, like, oh, he's the guy that makes the targets. He's the guy that does the letters, and the American flags. But so much more symbolic than I think more symbolic, especially seeing the retrospective, than I think even the art books give him credit for. Maybe that's not right to say the credit for, but I think he had a, they talk sometimes about how he was like breaking away from the, like, what was going on inside the artist's interior mind, or I forget exactly how they phrase it, but you look at these and like it is highly symbolic, and he is a highly expressive person in these things that are just flags and maps and numbers. There's a lot more going on there than I think it would initially, you know, initially be given credit for, or something, or that you sometimes get, seems like he's given credit for. I just find so much of his work to be so sad and lonely and interesting. I remember the whole reason I came down is because there was an article in the New York Times about his sort of like gray works or gray period that happened in the, I think, mid-60s, and this was after he had a relationship with Robert Rauschenberg that ended, it seems, not well, after they both went to France for a period of time. And I saw one of his pieces, I think it's called Voices, or maybe just Voice, in Houston a bunch of years ago, and I remember just being struck by how sad and lonely the piece felt. And then reading the article in the New York Times and seeing more of the pieces and reading the commentary that's written about what was going on in his life at the time, and that he, you know, broke from doing the flags and the targets to doing these very large gray pieces with other sort of like things attached to it, whether it's like silverware or just other kind of references to poetry. And beautiful in its sadness, and I feel like he's a lot more going on and a lot more interesting than even I gave him credit for when I was learning about him in art school. I mean, even when you see his targets and flags in person, they're really interesting because they're encaustic, so they have this sort of depth of surface that you don't necessarily expect when you see the pictures of it. But when you actually see the pieces and see them in series across like the stretch of his lifespan, of his body of work, it was really fascinating. So it was a lot of walking today, a lot of artwork, a lot of thinking, and, you know, checked out Chelsea Market a little bit, checked out the High Line, beautiful, freaking cold in February. At least today it was sunny and not raining, but the wind was brutal. But it was nice to get out and check things out. And then after all of that, came back to my hotel, rested a little bit, went back out. I was gonna call it a night, but man, I was worn out. But I felt a little too depressing to be in New York City for like a whole evening and not do anything. So I steeled myself to you know, get hype and went back out. There's a sort of a Tesla themed bar, not Tesla the car and stupid Elon Musk, but Nikola Tesla, right around the corner from where I'm staying. I went down there. The pictures look amazing. And of course, they had a private event going on, so I couldn't get in. Not a big deal. I went back a couple blocks, checked out a game bar, played some pinball poorly. And then, you know, really wanted to get some, because I'm right on the edge of Koreatown, wanted to get some good Korean fried chicken while I was here. And went to a place that had great reviews and went in. They were packed. They had a line waiting. But because I was a single person, you know, I asked if there was space for one, hoping I could just get at the bar. It turns out there's like an upstairs bar that was just fantastic, like great, interesting music. And there were only a couple lights that were all dim, but everything else, there was just a bunch of candles, like, I don't know, 40, 50 candles lit around the bar and around the tables and everything. So everything was very dark. You could see, it just had this great ambiance. And I got a single seat at the bar because there's an odd number of seats at the bar, and everybody else was twos or fours. I got lucky. I hung out, got some of the most expensive cocktails I've ever gotten, but they were really good. And the bar staff was amazing, just like sitting at the bar and watching them make their stuff, the, you know, professionalism they did that with, and chatting with customers about ideas of what drinks they might be interested in, was a lot of fun. Unfortunately, at the upstairs bar, they don't serve fried chicken, so I left there, went to another place, tried to go to one, I think it was like Anytime NYC, had great reviews, went there. It was going to be a 20-minute wait even for a single person because they didn't have a bar. Skipped that, went to another place. It was BB.Q Korea something. Got the most mammoth plate of Korean fried chicken. That is on the Instagram. What is it? Rated_in_podcast at Instagram. And it was really good. It was super crispy, sweet, spicy. Had a beer, but wow, it was, like they said, like 1,800 to like 2,500 calories for like the different versions of the chicken you could order. I think I got one of the ones that were probably closer to 2,000. I could only eat about half of it, and I was just food crazy. Bartender was nice and offered me a second bowl of pickled daikon, which was like nice and cut through some of the greasiness, but still could not finish more than half of it. And you know, called it a successful night, came back to the room. I'm working on packing. It's hard to believe that it has been like, I don't know, not even 40 hours that I've been here, and I feel like I've done a ton. Definitely missing Rachel and missing Laszlo. Definitely looking forward to sleeping in my own bed, and wish I had a day to recover before I have to go back to work, but that's the way it goes. You gotta do your trips when you can. I definitely highly recommend folks come to New York City if you've been considering it. I would say, honestly, compared to Georgia, even though there's so many more people here and they had such skyrocketing numbers for Omicron, I felt safer here than I did in Georgia in a lot of ways. I had to show my vaccine and my ID to match up my name on my vaccine card pretty much every place I went into. And like, everyone's wearing masks when they're out and about. When you're inside a restaurant and everybody's, you know, showed their cards that, you know, people are not wearing masks, and I guess that makes some sense. But it's kind of a nice balance of feeling cautious, but also feeling a little bit normal. So it's been a nice trip to New York City, and there's so much more here to do. I think tomorrow I'm going to go to a poster museum. I want to maybe get some, what is it called? Gimbap. And it is not Korean sushi, but it is a rice and fixings wrapped in seaweed. Seaweed is the gim, I suppose, and bap is the rice. So I'm going to try to get that for some lunch before I head back to the airport. But yeah, it's been a good trip and lots of good food. And look forward to, I don't know, if you've got anything to share about New York City, let me know. And let us know where we should try to go next. That's reasonably safe in these COVID times. We've got a lot planned for the spring. Mostly Rachel has things planned for the spring. And, always looking for new opportunities. All right. Well, thanks for listening. And check us out on Instagram and Facebook if you're interested. Like and subscribe if you haven't already. And I'd like to hear about your experiences traveling in New York City or wherever else you're able to travel in these crazy COVID times. All right. Thanks so much. Talk to you later. You can check us out at anchor.fm/reinitin. That's spelled R-E-I-N-I-T-I-N, all one word, no spaces. And you can leave us a message there. You can also follow us at Instagram at reinitin_podcast or email us at reinitin@ssdpress.org, also spelled R-E-I-N-I-T-I-N at ssdpress.org. Thanks again to all of our friends and family for all the support and for putting up with us. Have a great day.